The XX Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the XX Podcast for Thursday, November 1st, the Hipster Sexism Edition. This is Hannah Rosen, editor of XX. I'm here in the DC studio with Katie Waldman, who's an assistant editor at Slate and a frequent blogger at the XX Factor. Hello, Katie.
Hi.
And we are joined in New York, hopefully not flooded out, by Noreen Malone of The New Republic. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah. I am safe and sound. I got very, very lucky during the hurricane.
Good. So you're not like perched on a rock calling in with wind blowing like the newscasters do.
No.
They always find the most like rugged, handsome newscaster, you know, to have his hair windswept. And it's, you know, it all seems very romantic and dramatic. Okay, our three topics today. Since we are coming up on the election, we are going to talk about the war on women. What was that all about? And what do we do moving forward? The second is the recently defined phenomenon of hipster sexism and what we think about it, whether we even understand it. And the third is that gruesome New York nanny murder case and how it was treated by the media. So let's start with the election. I'm excited about the election. This election was unusual because it brought up not just the usual abortion issues, but a whole host of new women issues like contraception. That was the first surprise that came early on. Then the concept of legitimate rape, which I had never personally thought of in quite that way. Then the latest iteration, which is the question of whether women vote with their hormones or their fluttering eyelashes or whether any brains are involved in the fact that women would more likely to vote for Obama than men. So I'm going to start with Katie here. What's your view on the war on women? Like, having sat through elections, do you feel like this has been a particularly hostile to women moment, or what do you make of it now that it's winding down?
I think that war on women is kind of an inflammatory way to describe what's happening. But if you look at the policies that are popular now in the Republican Party, they're definitely not friendly to women. And some of them, as you mentioned, like have been kicking around for a while, abortion. And maybe we're just sort of intensifying the clamor because it's an election. And so, you know, everyone's coming out of the woodwork because these are polarizing issues. But I do think that, you know, maybe it has gotten a little bit worse. We were passing around that Will Salatin article earlier this week where he showed like a plurality of Republican senators or would-be senators opposing abortion, even in the case of rape. I'm not sure if that's a new development or if that has been the case for a while. There were Romney's sort of tone-deaf comments about wage equality at the town hall debate and sort of this sense that benevolent CEOs, male CEOs, would be the ones to rectify wage inequality as opposed to actual structural changes. So, I mean, I do think that women are right to have problems with the Republican Party at this point.
Well, I am actually most upset about the most recent iteration that we've seen, which is this sort of women vote with their hormones kind of idea, which I think CNN published an article that was actually removed from the internet pretty quickly. I didn't even see it before it was removed from the internet, but basically implying that women are creatures of hormones when it comes to the voting booth. And then Sean Duffy, who is a Republican candidate for Congress in, is it Wisconsin? I believe it's Wisconsin. But he was famously on The Real World. Anyway, he just put out an ad in which, you know, a couple of women are sitting around talking about the race and how they're going to vote.
I'm for Sean Duffy. He's pretty cool, actually. He's part of this new generation of leaders, the kind we need in Washington. He's a good husband and father, and he fights for small businesses like mine so I can keep the doors open and even hire more people.
He's the cute one, right? What about
you know, the idea that that's the way that we're thinking about voting is what I find actually more shocking than any of the discussion that's going on around rape and abortion, because in a way that stuff isn't surprising, right? Like that's been sort of bubbling up in the Republican platform for years, but the very way that it's being framed by both Democrats and Republicans that women are this special interest group is what's been most shocking to me.
You mean the cute thing because it's so condescending? I mean, you can't get angry about that CNN story. That was just so stupid.
I'm just upset that like this has been the sideshow, right? That like women are the like, when Republicans get desperate and they want to distract, they're like, well, here's a, you know, bizarre subgroup we're going to attack, you know, and it's 50% of the population. I just have had it up to here with it.
It's interesting. You know, I look at what's going on and all I see is like fear and counter reaction, right? Like I have some totally elaborate theory here, which is based in some fact, which is that the rise in single motherhood, right, and the decline of marriage is all in red states, right? So if you're a Republican right. person looking around at your district, what you see is the kind of most extreme phenomenon, say, of what I write about in my book, The End of Men. It's like women doing it for themselves, not necessarily in good ways, but like women not getting married, women holding up family. Basically, the destruction of families happening all around you. It's like the Bristol Palin effect. And yet the Republicans don't like mention the word single mother. It's just like a dirty word around them. And so it feels to me like what's going on with the Republicans is total sort of counterreaction, desperation, angry white mandom, right? Like angry white men voting for the Republican Party because their world is falling apart. And so that's the way in which it doesn't scare me that much, I guess.
Yeah, this is sort of my Ann Romney theory. This is my theory on why people are so into Ann Romney. It's not that she's like likable per se, but she represents this way of life in which your family makes enough money on one salary, you know, to have the mom stay at home and you can live a good life and you can have five kids and not be worried about getting food on the table. There's sort of this nostalgia for that lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the way that Americans are forever aspirational, like, you mm-hmm. know, it is illogical for a single mother to vote for Republicans. That's how we liberals all think, right? But in fact, it makes total sense because it's aspirational. It's like right. the fact that you live in a certain way and have a certain economic reality doesn't mean that that's the way that you want to live. So in fact, while I look at Ann Romney, by the way, your piece on Ann Romney was great. But I look at Ann Romney and I think like, you know, she can't even say the word single mother. Like in her convention speech, like she said everything but single mother.
I think she said working mother, and Michelle Obama, who actually was a working mother, didn't say it.
Yeah, well, she said working mother and then she said single father, of which there okay. are like 15 in America, right? I mean, the percentage of single fathers compared to single mothers is like, to me, that's the next great fight is over the single mother. Like she could go Democratic, you know, but probably she lives in red state and her heart and values are more Republican, but like she doesn't necessarily see herself reflected, certainly not in the Romneys, but she might want to someday. It's like that to me is the kind of interesting anthropological dynamic. Now, of course, we haven't at all addressed your condescension towards women in the Sean Duffy ad question yet,
right.
although we will get to more of that in our next topic. But have we convinced you to not be scared at all, like that you have the power or not quite, Katie?
I mean, that
you have the power.
I'm still a little bit scared. And I do want to note that the Republicans, I mean, they're not saying, you know, vote for us and you can capture the Ann Romney dream. They're saying you should vote for us because we're going to fix jobs and the economy. And, you know, that's what women should really be caring about. And what's frustrating to me about that line of argument is, you know, women are complex creatures. We're capable of caring about a lot of different things at the same time, you know, just in the same way that men care about a lot of things. Women care about a lot of things. They care about jobs, the economy. They care about control over their bodies. And so I hope that that point doesn't get lost.
The like very straightforwardly feminist side of me like identified with what Tina Fey said. It wasn't so much like feeling threatened as just sick of it. Like you're just sick of these guys like debating whether women should have it. It just seems really odd after a while to watch like one after another like Murdoch, whatever, however you pronounce, you know, his
Warlock.
Evil Warlock yeah. name. Exactly. And, you know, Todd Akin, all these like it's just after a while, you're just like, this seems ridiculous. Like at some point you just feel like there actually have to be more women sitting at that table in this conversation, or it just seems ridiculous. It's like watching your dad and your dad's friend like talk about, you know, whether your date went well or not. It just feels all wrong. And so, you know, Tina Fey had a quote. I can't remember exactly what she said, but it was more in the school of like, this is ridiculous and I'm just sick of it. You know, because the legitimate rape, like the polls that you're referring to that Will Salatin, like the hopeful thing about those polls is that no actual voters, like voters all believe in the rape exception. That was like in the 80% or something. Like
right.
it's only these lawmakers who have this, you know, crazy triangulated idea, which actually in some ways is intellectually honest about
right.
rape
the
exception.
The Murdoch thing, I think, is like a little different than the Akin thing, I would argue. I think that Murdoch is actually making the real pro-life case, right? He believes that life is a seamless garment, right? And he believes it for theological reasons. And it's sort of principled, like he expressed it in a terrible way, but I have a lot more respect for that than I do for something like what Todd Akin said.
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
You mean because of the bogus science?
Because of the bogus science inherent in what Aiken said?
Yeah, or why is Aiken worse to you than Warlock?
Well, I think we talked about this maybe last week on the Gabfest, or maybe when you were away, but I think Erin Carmon at Salon actually wrote a piece recently saying, and this view isn't original to her, but she expressed it really well, you know, either you believe that abortion is the ending of a life or you don't. Either you believe it should be legal or you don't. And, you know, the rape exception is a can of worms, you know, because people can claim that they were raped if they weren't. You know, there are all kinds of messy things that come along with that. But what I've been wondering about Murdoch and Aiken and all these guys is whether it's actually new or if it's just being disseminated more widely because of the internet and social media, and it sort of catches on in a way. I mean, this isn't the Romney campaign. You know, Romney endorsed Murdoch and I believe filmed an ad for him, but it isn't the Romney campaign going out and saying these things. These are, you know, local candidates who, you know, maybe 20 years ago, we wouldn't have read about what the local candidate in Kansas City was saying. And so I'm curious whether you think I'm just choosing to ignore what is actually a really strong rightward shift, or if that's part of it, or...
Yeah, this is a hard question because there's always been a part of the Republican Party, and I'm sure they've been pinned to the wall more to sort of think about their views in the rape exception. Probably they've never had to articulate it. And also the Republican platform doesn't have a rape exception, as we discussed last time. So it's unclear. On the other hand, like, how fast did Mitt Romney shut that discussion down and try and shut it down because they realize it's just like crazy talk and doesn't fit with what most Americans think. So to answer the broader question of whether the Republican Party has become more extreme in this election, I'm not sure. Like, the contraception thing to me is more evidence of that. Like, why the hell are they opening up that question? But the abortion debate seems to me like it's here with us forever and for a long time, and you're always going to be playing whack-a-mole with that one until the Democrats do better on the Supreme Court.
Okay, I have a question. Let's hit the Democrats a little bit. Are you at all upset by how obviously they're pandering to us, like us being women? Katie, I'm curious what you think. I just sometimes am a little, you know, it's a lesser insult than being told, you know, what you can and cannot do with your body, but I'm sort of a little annoyed by the things that are so clearly targeted just towards women.
Do you mean it's like Obama specifically talking about, you know, women's control over their body, like Obama doing the
I mean, no, I don't think that Obama advocating for reproductive rights or valuable health insurance things is pandering. I guess I'm annoyed by the messaging, you know, the you ladies school of political advertising, even... what was the name of the girl in the slideshows? Julie?
Oh, Julia.
Oh, yeah, that
Julia,
was a bad
Julia.
Moment.
I mean, yeah. All of that sort of, I can't put my finger on why it's annoying, but Julia did have policy behind it, right? It was, here are specific things that the Democratic Party is doing that are better for women than what the Republican Party wants to do. But there's just something about the way that 50% of the population has been dinged a special interest group that is getting under my skin in the last week or so.
You know, unfortunately, Sarah Haskins of Current TV has ruined my ability to fully digest all advertising targeted as women. Like, anytime I see that kind of advertising, all I see is Sarah Haskins, like, doing that, you know, yogurt is the official food of women dance that she does. And so, like, you watch the Julia and you're like, women, 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 women. Yeah, it does feel...
It feels like Obama's walking around handing out Yoplait, you know?
Right,
like,
exactly.
Like, that's how he's targeting us.
Exactly. Yo play, yo play. I mean, it's like the binders full of women thing, which we never got to talk about on the Gabfest. Like,
You weren't here.
Oh, I wasn't there. Sorry. Okay. Well, anyway, I was of two minds about that one. And I, you know, I never know what to think of it. Clearly, Katie, you didn't like it. But like, I never know, like, do we want the targeting or do we want to be ignored and treated just like everyone else? Like, I'm just not sure.
Right.
You know?
Well, I just think it's possible for an ad to target a particular part of me as a viewer. Like, this ad is directed towards the Katie who is interested in reproductive rights, and it doesn't necessarily reduce me to only someone who's interested in reproductive rights. But as someone who does have that interest, like, I'm glad to know that they've got my back there. And so I think, you know, I don't feel that pandered to. I guess, like, if the messaging is condescending, if it's conveyed in a sort of patronizing way, then I'll get a little annoyed. But I mean, being identified as a special interest group or part of a special interest group doesn't bother me as long as there's like a broader sense of the other interests that I might have as a voter.
So when you have all these political ads in a convention are always about dudes doing things in factories, you know, which very few dudes do anymore. So it's like, you know, that's targeted to guys. That's like that's meant, it's not explicit necessarily, but it's designed to kind of tap into your like, I'm a dude and I do dudely things. And that's okay. Like maybe it speaks to something in them but doesn't reduce them to the guy wielding the hammer. Now, do you guys think the Sean Duffy ad, the Emma and Olivia ad, where she says he's the cute one, right? Like was that a total misreading? Like wouldn't anybody, Republican or Democrat, woman, just be irritated by that even if she thought that he was cute and even if she voted for him because she thought it was interesting to have a reality TV contestant as her representative? Like doesn't that just seem like they shouldn't have done that? Like it's just making it so explicit is just an error, or is it the only way he could get attention?
First of all, nothing makes someone less cute than by thinking that they're cute, right?
Right.
You know? He's undermining his own number one strategy there. Yeah, that's just like a joke.
Because he sat in the room and was like, yeah, all the ladies think I'm cute. And
right,
so then,
right.
So of course
or
we should
like
run
his
this.
Consultants were sitting around and being like, what can we lead with? Like, what's his number one strongest, you know? And he's like, he's kind of cute, you know? And so that's pretty bad.
I think maybe you can get away with one line like that per commercial, but like given that they started with latte and cappuccino, it was overload. Like I could sort of possibly in some alternate universe imagine being charmed if this was an Obama ad and it was like, oh, and he's pretty cute. You know, it would seem sort of ironic, and I guess we'll get to that topic later.
I want to move on to the next topic, but you know that Todd Evan Krieger, You're My Man, did you guys watch that wedding video? Now, Mochaccino's in the hood. It was like my children are obsessed with it. It's so embarrassing. It was listed as like the single most embarrassing wedding video ever made, and my children watch it over and over again because even they, at their level of young irony, understand why this is deeply embarrassing, but that's what the Sean Duffy ad reminded me of. Okay, let's move on to our second topic, which is hipster sexism, which Sean Duffy leads us nicely into and which I'm really excited to talk about. But before we do, I want to welcome back one of our favorite and most loyal sponsors, Audible.com, which is the leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the web. They have 100,000 audiobooks, many of which I listen to in my car, which our loyal listeners already know that about me. And for XXX listeners who aren't Audible members, you can get a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX. That's not XXX, but XX. And we are going to recommend this week, thanks to our intern, Ginny Choi, The Bell Jar, which is read by Maggie Gyllenhaal, which is just a fabulous combination, really. And you will see why we recommend that in a moment when we start talking about hipster sexism. Not that Maggie Gyllenhaal is a sexist, but she is a hipster, so it takes us halfway there. So this segment is based on a story that was written by, how do you pronounce her name, Alyssa Court? Is it
Court? That's what I would guess.
Or Court. Anyway, she has defined in the New York Magazine blog, The Cut, the women's blog, she defined the phenomenon of hipster sexism, which is us men and women both saying sexist things but in ironic ways. So, for example, a guy calling his wife or girlfriend his ball and chain, and Terry Richardson is one example she gave. He's the art photographer who is admired by women even though he's like a sexist bastard and does terrible things, but somehow he gets away with it because he's really cool. And so it's really complicated and I don't exactly understand it and I'd really like to define it. So Noreen, you are going to have to help me here and because you live in Brooklyn and like I really am interested in this. I don't have my finger on it yet. So can you try and explain to me a little better what the hell is hipster sexism?
So hipster sexism, which I think is alive and well and walking among us in Brooklyn and other places, I think is the assumption that because you fit certain categories, you are someone who lives in an urban area, you are someone who got a liberal arts education, you are someone who, if asked, would say, you know, sexism is terrible, I believe in the Lilly Ledbetter Act and abortion rights. Because you check all of these boxes, you can sort of say whatever you want, you know, and because you're not a conservative man in, you know, deepest Missouri, you can get away with doing stuff or saying stuff that is, frankly, sexist. So in the piece, Alyssa makes a distinction between classic sexism, which, you know, she'd put Todd Akin and Murdoch under, and then hipster sexism, which is, you know, Terry Richardson taking a picture of Kate Upton, you know, licking a lollipop and putting it on the cover of GQ or whatever. And there's just like a thin film of irony, right, that separates Terry Richardson from, you know, Todd Akin. And I'm not sure that's entirely true, but I think there's something really insidious about this assumption that, like, once we've gotten past the sincere belief that women aren't as good as men, we can sort of just, like, wink and nod at it. Like, for the visual jokes that Terry Richardson are making, for them to be recognizable, people have to sort of believe them, right, in some way. And that's what I think is a little more insidious.
Now, is the difference – the thin film of irony doesn't have to be explicit, right? It's not like there's quotation marks. Terry Richardson is actually weirdly a sexist bastard. So is it merely the difference – in who is doing it? So, you know, that Sean Duffy ad that we just mentioned is not radically different than the Lena Dunham ad where she pretends to be the thing that the Sean Duffy ad woman is, right? Like Lena Dunham pretends to be her sort of I lost, you know, my first time ad where mm-hmm. she it seems as if she's talking about sex when she's actually talking about voting for Obama. Let's say you literally took the exact same script from the Sean Duffy ad and you put it in Lena Dunham's mouth, where she said she's voting for Obama because he's cute. Then it's hipster?
I actually didn't think the Lena Dunham ad was a great example of hipster sexism. And this is a somewhat reductive reading, but I think because she is a woman, I think that made a bit of a difference.
Uh-huh.
I don't think there's anything damaging about implying that women like talking about sex or that women like sex. I don't find that to be a damaging stereotype, which is what I guess conservatives were very angry about with the Lena Dunham
But wasn't
ad.
She playing like a version of the woman in that CNN piece who like votes with her hormone? Like that's what she
no,
was making fun
she
of.
She was playing a version of her girl's character. I honestly didn't think it was that funny. Like
right.
I think
right.
Lena Dunham's really funny. I just thought it was like the joke was low hanging fruit.
Right.
And also as a side note, I'm a little upset. She was old enough to vote for Kerry or
right.
Bush in that election. Come on. Come on. I don't think that the Lena Dunham ad is what I would think of as hipster sexism. I sort of immediately, when I read that piece, I was like, yes, you know, there are plenty of guys I know who are sort of educated, urban types. They get away with saying a lot of things.
But now your theory is that there's some truth to the stereotype. My truth is that we are at some level a little beyond it. Like she makes the point that there was hipster racism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think there's hipster racism. I have not ever seen an example of hipster racism. Like whereas hipster racism is still
a
taboo.
The whole thing is like, I mean, and some of that is just being as like outrageous as possible to like offend people. It's ironic racism.
Right.
Like there's no other way to phrase it.
Sort of the view that's materializing for me now is it's a thing, but it doesn't work. So like, yes, it happens. But at the same time, I don't think that it's a good thing. And I don't think it's accomplishing what hipster sexists want it to, because basically it requires someone else in the room to hear what you're saying and then translate that in their heads into what you actually mean, which is that sexism is bad. So it puts you at the mercy of the audience. And if the audience is not as enlightened as the hipster sexist, then basically they're just hearing a reaffirmation of their classic sexist views. And you know, and then if you already have the beliefs that the hipster sexists want you to have, then what's the point of just preaching to the choir?
Wait, but are they preaching, though? Like, I am unsure. I'm unconvinced that people who are walking this tightrope, I'm unsure that they're actually all that enlightened. I think they're getting away with stuff that they wouldn't otherwise.
Here's my closest run-in with hipster sexism. I walked into a store in Dumbo one time. I was shopping, and this store was for dudes, you know, not for me. And the store was entirely stocked with kind of ironic maleness. So it was like hunter jackets, old flasks, and like piles and piles of old Playboys. This is clearly hipster sexism, right? It's like mm-hmm. we're being man in quotation marks. As like a woman in that store, I was like, is this – am I supposed to be offended? Like, or do I need to collude? Because it sounds like implicit in Melissa's story is that for hipster sexism to work, the hipster women have to be colluding in it. Like she points out that Terry Richardson's girlfriend is Lena Dunham's best friend, right? Audrey Gelman. So there has to be some way – and it can't be like a homoerotic frat boy experience because then it's closer to classic sexism. It has mm-hmm. to be something in which women are involved and a part of and laughing with, right?
Okay. So I have a theory about this. How hipster women get involved in hipster sexism is not through like the gender angle but through the subversiveness angle.
Right.
So like part of being a hipster is like you're transgressing norms. And so as feminism moves into the mainstream, like it's suddenly more transgressive to start calling your female friends skanks and like do all these sexist things than it is to, you know, agitate for reproductive rights or whatever. So they sort of get to have their cake and eat it too. They get to be kind of subversive and shocking and outrageous. And at the same time, they can always hide behind that sort of, as you said, film of irony and say, oh, but you know, I'm a hipster and irony is my thing. So of course, I'm socially conscious at the core.
Right. So, Noreen, wasn't it you and Jess who said that people in college called each other sluts, which the old lady, found shocking? But like...
Right. It's exactly that, which I don't like. And it makes me feel like an old lady to say that, because I don't actually think, like, I think hipster is sort of a misleading term here, and it makes us think that it's just happening with the Terry Richardsons of the world. But I think, like, more generally, like, progressive sexism would fall under it too, right? Like, I keep saying the same thing over and over again, but just because someone believes in reproductive rights does not mean that they are actually not a sexist.
I mean, her example of Lena, of the show Girls, was interesting to me, because it's like, can you stray into obviously sexist, what we would consider sexist portrayals of sex, for example, and are you being ironic there, or are you just being honest? Like, that's the example she kept hammering on, and that's where she lost me, because I was like, well, but that's a sort of sexual dynamic that is true. So why does that fall into the category of ironic sexism? It doesn't seem ironic to me at all. It seems to me completely sort of weird and odd and maybe particular and maybe doesn't represent anyone but this character, but still doesn't seem ironic, you know?
And I guess my reading is that I think Lena Dunham is pointing out a lot of hipster sexism. I think that's a lot of what her show is about, actually. That relationship that she has with Adam in the early going is, I think, a lot of that, as she's mining that. I think that's a little different. That's like meta, that's meta on top of meta sexism or something.
Yeah, maybe this is like our conversation about raunch culture, that this is more connected to the question of whether in all these raunch culture movies we are enacting a male fantasy or, like, you know, just owning it back, kind of.
Right.
And there's no real answer to that question. That's just the question that's out there. All right, we need Alyssa to help us completely figure it out, but it's a super interesting phenomenon that she outlined. Let's move on to our last topic, which is this horrible nanny murder case, which was on the front page of the Times for a couple of days running. It was the story of the Krim family, the mother who came home and found that two of her three children had been murdered, likely by their nanny, in their house while she was out taking a walk. Always when we have these child killing, especially upper class, elite child killing stories, they become pretty quickly a reflection of our culture's obsession about motherhood and how we cover motherhood and talk about motherhood in one way or another. And this story is no exception. There were two interesting points that have come out of this story in terms of the broader culture. One was by Alyssa Rosenberg, our own blogger, who wrote about this very interesting fact that the mother had kept a mommy blog over the years of her children, which gave her a presence and a humanity during the course of the coverage, because she's in total shell shock, of course, and not talking to the press. So there was lots of details out there about their life, whereas the nanny, of course, had no such thing. And so, you know, was completely sort of distant, mysterious, and dark as a result. And I thought that was a very interesting point to make.
I was actually really a little bit upset by the coverage. The nanny, maybe she has been now, but as of 2 or 3 days ago, she hadn't actually officially been charged. And there were a ton of stories, you know, not in newspapers, but sort of in secondary outlets. Like Gawker ran a story about, you know, the way parents in New York were reacting to this. And they didn't even use the word alleged to discuss whether the nanny had done it or not. I have no idea what happened in that apartment. I just read the news. But in the way it's been presented in the news accounts, he said, she said, and because it sort of mines all of our anxieties in a certain way, the nanny is just the killer already, whether or not she did it or not. She's not the alleged killer. She's already the killer. That was a little upsetting to read, and I think that Alyssa is right to pinpoint the access that we had to the mother's life as something that helped her in the public eye.
Right, and a way in which she became immediately relatable. Katie, do you have any reaction to the blog aspect of the mother's life?
It's unfortunate that Ortega didn't have – is that how you say your name,
yeah,
Ortega? That she didn't have some sort of online presence, because already, like, the coverage was sort of painting her as an other. You know, she was newly naturalized, I guess, 2 years from the Dominican Republic. And a lot of people were coming out with, you know, where is she from? And, you know, foreign nannies, this is such a problem. This is, you know, a scourge for our children.
People in message boards, right?
Yeah. So not like the mainstream press, but, you know, the mystery that surrounds anyone who doesn't leave a lot of footprints online was compounded by this sort of mission to make her an other racially or nationally. And I just found that kind of an uneasy thing to watch, too.
I mean, I frankly never thought about it. I never thought about online presence in that way, and the way in which we immediately think of someone who has an online presence is sort of completely accessible and lacking in suspicion, and then the way in which all these vast numbers of people – like it seems in this case, you know, it's pretty gruesome. There's a lot of evidence. It's a really weird story. But you can imagine taking this idea out to other cases where you have an immigrant or whatever who's accused of a crime and just seems like a blank slate because mm-hmm. they don't have a media presence and they don't have a blog and, you know, how important that is these days to our understanding of someone. Now, I have to say, as a mother and particularly as a working mother who was on book tour and traveling at the time I read the story, the one thing that I noticed about the story is the way in which reporters and news stories went out of their way to make us understand that this mom wasn't really working and that this nanny wasn't really a full-time nanny, that that was an important trope to the story. I mean, people ignored it anyway. Like Fox News said something like, this will send a chill down the spine of working mothers, which is like, not really, but but that was something that it just kind of broke my heart to see that happening in every nanny story, because it does happen in every nanny story. That Louise Woodward story, that British woman who – that shaken baby syndrome case. Like, you know, I hate the way in a lot of these caretaker stories, because it is so much more often relatives who do damage to children than it is strangers. And yet the trope of the sort of horror at strangers taking care of your children and the way in which a nanny who you could have known your whole life becomes – stranger in these moments. And, you know, every detail of that story was like the mom was only an art teacher. She only taught 1 hour a week. She was, in fact, with her other child when the nanny was this children, like as if the mom had been like a corporate lawyer, like somehow she would have been more culpable than she was because she was just an art teacher who taught at the museum every once in a while.
Yeah, I didn't see people making that distinction quite as much. I think on, you know, message boards like Urban Baby, where people sort of let their worst sides come out, there was a little bit of that, you know, people saying, well, this is why I, you know, would never, ever leave the home. But I think just in general, people weren't using it to point fingers as much as they were to just sort of have a moment where they were considering what their worst nightmare was, right? Because this is actually it. The urban horror story come to life. And I think people were just more focused on that than they were in blaming the mother. I think that was more of a sort of minority undercurrent thing that was going on.
The fact that the mother didn't work, I think, made this the worst story possible, right? Because right. there was no easy way for anybody to explain to themselves or explain away the horror that had happened. Like, here was a mother who was, like, incredibly loving, around all the time. Check one. Here was a mother who seemed to know this nanny really well. They'd worked for her for a long time. They'd even visited her family in the Dominican Republic. Like, there was you're like at the heart of darkness here. Like, there's just no easy narrative you can tell about this horrible story, which allows you to say to yourself, you know, this could never happen to me, or, you know, this will never happen normally. It's just like you've come to some total mystery of terrible human behavior. All right. Anybody else have anything to say? Sorry about this downer. I'm really sorry. Okay. So now let's do our endorsements. Noreen, why don't you go first?
So I have been watching kind of obsessively this British show, The Thick of It. Have either of you guys watched that?
Yes.
No.
It is amazing. It's by the same guy who directed Veep and In the Loop. And it's just a tour de force of swearing. It's like a far more trenchant version of The Office. But, like, it's The Office meets The West Wing, but, like, just amazingly jaded. It's just perfect.
It's
can't get enough of it.
It's so jaded. It's amazing. Now, do you put on the subtitles or not?
No.
Every once in a while, I'm like, what? Like,
I didn't even know that was an option.
Yes, because funny. I literally can't understand what they're saying sometimes. It's so awesome. You know, I was in London recently for my book tour, and it was so delightful because they're so vicious in a way that I find so awesome, because it's just all out there. It's like parliamentary debate culture. There's just kind of a culture of sort of viciousness. It's like play acting. It's like a theater of viciousness, but I actually love it. So, yes, I love that show. I'm not going to talk about Nashville because I love Nashville. That would be my recommendation, but you and I have discussed Nashville already, which I love. I am actually going to recommend Lois Lowry's book, Son, which is not for grownups, really. It's like a YA book. It's the fourth in her series. I'm a huge Lois Lowry fan. The Willoughbys is one of my favorite books. She's completely hilarious, has a very wry British sensibility. Anyway, The Son is a sort of dystopia and very moving dystopia about a world in which women just give birth but are not allowed to have any relationship with their children except for this one mom who becomes obsessed with her children. It's Tell Me You Love Me that it reminds me of. It's a sort of watered-down version of Tell Me You Love Me, and it's a really, really great book that my daughter is going to read after I do. Katie.
Cool. Am I allowed to recommend a holiday? I have backups if not.
Yes, but, you can recommend a holiday, sure.
This is a little-known holiday developed by Neil Gaiman, the author and graphic novelist, and it's basically pegged to Halloween. It's called All Hallows Read. And basically, through the week of Halloween, participants are instructed to give their friends and loved ones scary books. So actually, if you're looking for scary book recommendations, I think Slate just posted a few on our culture blog. But I would definitely encourage everyone to curl up with a creepy novel at some point this week to celebrate.
That's really awesome because my daughter hates Halloween and she doesn't like dressing up and she hates trick-or-treating, but she loves reading scary dystopian novels. So like, I feel like this is made for her. So that's awesome. Okay, that is it for this week. I'm really glad to be back on the podcast. I'm sorry I missed last week.
We're glad to have you back.
I want to thank Ginny, our intern, who's sitting in with us today for researching the podcast. As always, Abdul Rufus for engineering the podcast. And finally, I want to thank Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. Please, as always, come on our Facebook page, join us. And I wish I'd send this sooner in the podcast, but I continue to adore our podcast fans. I have yet to have a book event where podcast fans did not come. Show up, ask me to sign a book. They're always my best conversations on the book signing line. And you guys have gotten into the habit now of telling me where you listen to the XX podcast. And I love that as well. So I hope to see more of you. Thank you. And join us again in a couple of weeks.